Chapter 8, The Roots of Racial Difference. At the age of 10, I kept two white female rats in our garage in a large wooden box I had built. It had a wood frame and fine mesh chicken wire top that fit poorly. On a spring day, I discovered that one of my rats was showing signs of gestation. Even though I did not understand it, I supposed that I had mistaken a male rat for a female. I couldn't understand why the father looked so female, for I had a lot of familiarity with white rats, raising and selling them to the local pet stores and the Woolworth store near my home. The babies were finally born, little pink sacks with four protruding legs and eager mouths, but just outlines of closed eyes and ears. Each day I played with the little ones, but as they grew older, they seemed decidedly different from their mother and the other rat whom I presumed must be their father. As they began to grow their new coats, the fur grew out not white, but gray. Their behavior seemed strange as well. By the time they were a few weeks old, equivalent to a human's teenage years, no matter how often I held them, the brood acted increasingly wild and uncontrollable. They had differences that went much further than simply the gray color of their coats. Their wildness progressed to the point that whenever I put my hand into the cage, the sawdust and wood shavings went flying as they scattered fearfully from the very same human hand that had lovingly fondled and petted them from birth. They were fast, excitable, quick to bite, and physically superior to the domesticated breed. Pet white rats are very passive, slow-moving, deliberate creatures, whereas their wild rat cousins are excitable, lightning-quick, aggressive, and violent. Finally, I came to the realization that both white rats in the cage were actually female, and that a wild rat had gnawed and squeezed into the wooden cage and mated with one of them. A few years later, as I studied the realities of human race, I understood fully that the different breeds of rats are the genetic equivalent of human races. Breeding can occur between different races, even when there may still be dramatic genetic differences between them. The contrast between races can be in physical or psychological traits and in social or individual behavior. The behavior of those half-white, half-wild rats obviously was not the result of their environment. I had provided them with the same nurturing as for my white rats. In fact, they were suckled by their white rat mother and raised with two white rat females and constant human intervention. But their behavior was wild. As a teenager looking to the race question, I look back on the rat episode a few years earlier. It seemed obvious that the difference in the behavior of my rats was wholly the result of genetics. The fact that the environment for the mixed breed rats was the same as for the completely domesticated ones suggested that there was a physical difference between the brains and hormones of the domesticated white rats and those of the breed of half-wild gray rats. These genetic differences had powerful behavioral effects. There were other telltale proofs of the power of heredity from my menagerie of childhood. In the course of my grade school years, I had dozens of pets that I had captured from the swamps and forests near my home. Some breeds were amenable to domestication if reared from birth, while others were not, even though they received the same nurturing from me. As I pondered the power of heredity and environment, another unforgettable incident of my childhood came to mind. A friend found a tiny, hungry, newborn kitten in my neighborhood shortly after his pet dog had given birth to a litter of four pups. Weak and delicate, its eyes barely open, the kitten seemed likely to die. As an experiment, my friend removed one of the puppies from his mother and rubbed it thoroughly all over the tiny kitten, and then he nestled both of them among the other pups of the nursing mother. To his surprise, the mother allowed the kitten to nurse. After a couple of weeks, it became healthy and robust. I loved to go over to my friend's house to see the unusual sight of a kitten nursing and growing up among puppies. Although the kitten had been nursed by a dog, and although my friend had treated the kitten and the puppies alike, the kitten still grew up with a distinctly different personality than the rest of the litter. The kitten stalked its prey and then suddenly pounced, whereas the puppies ran headlong to their targets. In physical tussles with the pups, the kitten used its paws as its primary weapons, whereas the dogs preferred using their jaws. The kitten never attempted to mimic the sharp barks of its adopted brothers and sisters, instead preferring the feline hiss of anger or the meow of desire. After having been in the company of dogs almost its entire young life, and never having even seen another cat, she looked and behaved like a perfectly normal cat. And by the way, it never came when we called it. Thinking back on these things, I tried to reduce what I knew to the simplest form. Why does a dog bark and a cat meow? I asked myself. And I answered my own inquiry. Because a dog's brain is constructed in a way that makes him bark and behave like a dog, and a cat's brain is built in a way, a form, that makes it meow and behave like a cat. Wanting to expand my theory, I called a friend of mine from school whose family owned a dog kennel and had bred dogs for more than 30 years. He explained to me that different breeds of dogs had distinctly different personalities. Violence, aggression, passivity, loyalty, stoicism, excitability, intelligence, all these things sharply varied in the many breeds of dogs. For example, he explained that the Chihuahua is extremely excitable and hyperactive by nature, whereas the Saint Bernard is stable and stoic. He talked about the natural violent aggression of the pit bull as compared to the naturally friendly disposition of the golden retriever. My friend explained why parents of small children often chose a golden retriever as their pet because the breed is exceptionally friendly and protective of children. Even when children torment the golden retriever, he told me, the breed will rarely respond violently toward them. I also picked up an interesting little book on the history of dog breeding and found that not only did dogs have distinct personalities according to their breed, but that they were bred by man precisely for those personalities as well as for physical characteristics such as size and color. Any dog trainer would laugh if told that the only difference in dog breeds is the color of their coats. If a dog's distinct personality characteristics are not created solely by its training, the tendencies must be carried in the structure of its brain and determined by genes. Armed with my newly gained knowledge, I asked my biology teacher how the classifications of breeds of dogs compared to the classifications of the races of mankind. Taken aback, she told me that she had never before been asked that question by any student, but she said that breed and race are essentially two words for the same biological classification, subspecies. All dogs are members of the species Canis familiaris, of which there are at least 140 different breeds, subspecies, or races. She repeated what I already knew, that the commonly accepted test for whether two groups were different species or subspecies of the same species was whether they could interbreed. The various breeds of dogs, just as the various races of humans, can interbreed in spite of obvious inherent differences. Even though she taught biology, which included human biology, she became very uncomfortable comparing differences in human races with those of breeds of horses or dogs. It was as though I had trespassed on forbidden ground, but I saw nothing heretical about the inquiry. To understand those distinctions that separated man from the other species and to comprehend the differences in mankind itself seemed important. How could we begin to understand the world around us without having an understanding of what makes us the way we are? By then, I knew that no fewer than 1,000 scientific studies had demonstrated that there was a significant difference in IQ between white and black races, that IQ differences have a major impact on individual socioeconomic success, and that ample evidence showed heredity rather than environment was the major source of this difference. And to the listener of this audiobook, at that point I document a number of major studies and major books that list these studies. The evidence is overwhelming on this factor, and you need to go to the book text itself to get that data. Books and articles on IQ led me to other studies revealing that significant differences existed between the brains of blacks and whites. In fact, the data on the racial differences in brain structure were almost as clear-cut as those based on psychological testing. I found that Negro and white brains had been weighed, compared, and analyzed for decades, and the results consistently showed black brains were smaller than white and East Asian brains. As an illustration of the marked difference, even though blacks are physically larger than East Asians by a great margin, the latter have the larger and heavier brains. In recent years, Professor J. Philip Rushton at the University of Western Ontario in Canada has vigorously pursued research on race differences in brain size. In a series of articles and books, he has analyzed new data sets and summarized old ones. What follows is based on a summary he provided in his book, Race, Evolution, and Behavior. I think the cutting-edge book on this subject. Four different methods have been used to measure brain size. They have been MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. They've been weighing the brain, the wet brain at autopsy, measuring the volume of an empty skull, and measuring the outside of the head. Every one of these studies of racial groups show that whites and East Asians consistently average larger brains than blacks. The difference amounts to about 5 cubic inches in cranial capacity, or about 100 grams in weight, a quarter of a pound. These are very large differences because each cubic inch of brain tissue contains millions of cells and billions of connections. The race differences in brain size remain even after adjustments are made for body size. Wet brain weight at autopsy. In the 19th century, the famous neurologist Paul Broca found that East Asians and whites averaged larger and heavier brains than blacks. Broca also found that white brains had more surface folding than black brains. The more folded the surface of the brain, the more brain cells it can contain. White brains also had larger frontal lobes, which are used in self-control and planning. In 1906, Robert Bean reported on 150 brains of autopsied blacks and whites in the American Journal of Anatomy. He found about 100 grams of difference, or one quarter pound difference. Moreover, Bean found that brain weights in blacks increased with the amount of white ancestry, as measured independently from skin color. Like Broca before him, Bean also found that brains of blacks were less folded than those of whites and had fewer fibers leading to the frontal lobes. In 1934, Vent reported the results of an autopsy study of brain weights from black Africans in the Journal of Anatomy. He found that the brains of Africans were 10% lighter than those of whites. In the 1934 issue of Science, a well-known biologist, Raymond Pearl, reviewed autopsy results from dozens of black and white soldiers who had died of pneumonia in the American Civil War, 1861 to 1865. He found that the brains of whites weighed 100 grams more than the brains of blacks. And among blacks, Pearl also found that brain weights increased with the amount of white ancestry. In a 1970 article in the American Journal of Physical Anthropology, Philip Tobias claimed that all these early autopsy studies were wrong. He said that they ignored factors like sex, body size, age of death, childhood nutrition, organ of sample, occupation, and cause of death. However, subsequent work showed that it was Tobias who was wrong and not the earlier studies. In 1980, for instance, a medical team led by Kenneth Ho at the University of Wisconsin confirmed the black-white differences. Their study, published in the Archives of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine, avoided the possible errors claimed by Tobias. Original brain weight data for 1,261 American adults showed that whites averaged 100 grams more brain weight than blacks. Because the blacks in the study were similar in body size to whites, differences in body size could not explain the race differences in brain size. Measuring skull size. Now, this method involves filling skulls with packing material. In the 19th century, American anthropologist Samuel George Morton studied over 1,000 skulls. He found that blacks averaged 5 cubic inches smaller than whites. In 1942, autonomist Catherine Simmons reported on over 2,000 skulls in the Journal of Human Biology. She confirmed Morton's earlier work finding that whites had larger skulls than blacks. Because the blacks in her sample were taller than the whites, the skull differences could not be due to body size. Kenneth Beals and his team at the Washington State University further confirmed these findings in the 1984 issue of Current Anthropology. They reported the measurements of up to 20,000 skulls from around the world. Skull size varied with places of origin. Skulls from East Asia were even larger than those from Europe, which were 5 cubic centimeters larger than those from Africa. MRI. The only MRI study that has reported on racial differences in brain size has confirmed them. Harvey et al., 1994, looked at over 100 people in Britain, published in the Journal of Psychological Medicine. The study found that black Africans and West Indians averaged a smaller brain size than whites. Next, measuring living heads. Rushton, 1997, showed that race differences in brain size are observable at birth. He analyzed recorded head circumference measurements and IQ scores from 35,000 children in the National Collaborative Perinatal Project, which followed children from birth to age 7. Roman, Nichols, Chagassi, and Kennedy, 1987. Using the head circumference measures to estimate cranial capacity at birth, 4 months, 1 year, and 7 years, Rushton found that at each of these ages, the East Asian American children averaged larger cranial capacities than did the white children, who averaged larger cranial capacities, volumes, than did the black children. Within each race, cranial capacity correlated with IQ scores. Since the East Asian American children were the shortest in nature and the lightest in weight, while the black children were the tallest in stature and the heaviest in weight, these average race differences in brain size were not due to body size. Rushton also estimated cranial capacities in adults from external head size measurements, length, width, height. In 5 studies of large archival data sets, Rushton, 1992, examined measurements from a stratified random sample of over 6,000 U.S. Army personnel and found that the average cranial capacity of East Asians, whites, and blacks were, respectively, 1,416, 1,380, and 1,359 square centimeters, respectively, even after adjusting for the effects of body size, sex, and military rank. Now, this is a lot of data, and again, you can get more information on this in the text of My Awakening, so the hard copy is a much better reference here. I can just basically refer to them in the audio book. And this may be a little tedious for some of the listeners because it's a lot of factual data. But it's important that you understand the incredible weight of scientific evidence of real average differences between races. In another study, Rushton, 1993, reanalyzed a set of anthropometric data originally published by Melville Hershkovitz, who concluded that there were not race differences in cranial capacity. Rushton found that, in fact, the white samples of Hershkovitz averaged a cranial capacity of 1,421 and blacks 1,295 square centimeters. In a 4th study, Rushton, 1994, analyzed data obtained on tens of thousands of people from around the world collated by the International Labor Office in Geneva, Switzerland. He found that after adjusting for the effects of body size and sex, samples from the Pacific Rim, Europe, and Africa had average cranial capacities of 1,308, 1,297, and 1,241 centimeters, respectively. Finally, Rushton and Osborne, 1995, analyzed the Georgia twin study of adolescents and found that after correcting for body size and sex, whites had average cranial capacity of 1,269 and blacks 1,251 centimeters. Naturally, the averages vary between samples and the races do overlap, but the results from different methods on different samples consistently show the same average pattern. In other words, whites and East Asians average larger brains than blacks. Rushton estimated that whites and East Asians average at least 500 million more brain cells than do blacks, and that these differences in brain size go a long way to explain the differences in IQ and cultural achievement. There is obviously no more important organ in the human body than the brain. It is what truly distinguishes us from both our closer and more remote relatives on the evolutionary ladder. In fact, the size and the form of the brain is matter-of-factly used by anthropologists as a barometer of the evolutionary development of man. Ironically, the same anthropologists who track the evolutionary development of mankind by his increased cranial capacity often insist that racial differences in brain size and morphology of modern man are not important. The evidence, however, is clear. Size, physiology, and morphology and chemistry of the brain have much to do with the psychological distinctions of individuals and the broad characteristics that distinguish between different races. Science has found significant genetic influences on intelligence, behavior, and achievement in the different races. The depth of those differences we are now only beginning to fully grasp. Now, it's important to understand the arguments the racial egalitarian use against these things, and these are the arguments that 99% of the people hear. They don't hear this kind of data that I'm talking about because this confronts the egalitarian principle. I'm diverging from my book here, but I'm offering a little audio commentary. Here's the racial egalitarian lines of defense in response to this data. Number one, and response to all the things I've talked about so far in the book. One, the first response is that blacks are really not less intelligent. And that's a common argument. But when critics point out that hundreds of studies show a consistent and dramatic lower IQ scores for blacks, egalitarians allege that. Two, differences in IQ are the result of racially biased tests. But when proven that they are not racially or culturally biased, then they argue that three, lower average black IQs are simply a result of socioeconomic factors. But when sharp differences show up, even when socioeconomic factors for whites and blacks are matched, then they retreat to saying that four, environmental stimulation of young blacks in programs such as Head Start will bring up the black children to the white IQ level. But when they show the Head Start result in an absolutely no increase in black IQ, and five, IQ really does not mean anything anyway. But when shown that hundreds of social scientists prove that IQ has a tremendous impact on educational and socioeconomic success, they finally retreat to an egalitarian defense that accepts the biological determination of intelligence. They then allege that poor nutrition is responsible for the differences in mental development of blacks and whites. Now, the final egalitarian defense is interesting in that it accepts that intelligence is important and rooted in the biology and formation of the brain itself. Instead of trying to dispute the natural role of genes in the architecture and development of the brains, the egalitarians simply argue that nutrition and other biological factors of the mother and the young child dramatically affect the brain's development. They argue that blacks, because they are poorer than whites on average, are nutritionally deprived and thus held back in the development of their brains. Of course, in my audio version here, I say there's a lot of refutation to that. For example, European children who grew up in the stress and starvation of the last years of the Second World War and the immediate post-war years show no ill effects in lower IQ. The IQ average compares favorably with the population groups in the period before and after this titanic conflict in which over 60 million people perished. The scientific studies of nutrition show that there is little difference between the nutrition of black and white children. Robert Rector showed in a survey by the United States Department of Agriculture that black preschool children actually consume more protein than do average white children. Children in families 75% below the poverty line actually consume as much of the major vitamins as children 300% above the poverty line. The argument that the brains of young blacks are malnourished is almost laughable when one looks at the absolute black domination of track and field, basketball, and football. It's hard to imagine that the same nutrition that enables blacks to develop nutritionally healthy bodies, that help them make 15 times per capita more representation than whites in these major sports, have fed their bodies but, quote, starved their brains. Documentation, again, is available in my hard text. Racial differences also are obvious in the physical realm. In the 1960s, blacks dominated the male sprinting events at the Olympics, and with integration of sports, they were rapidly increasing their numbers in professional basketball and football. At this writing, blacks now make up approximately 80% of the National Basketball Association, 66% of the National Football League, and 100% of the top 50 male sprinters in the world who compete in professional and Olympic 100 and 200 meter dashes. Now this is true, although well organized, track and field is much more prevalent in white nations than black ones. And although there are many times more whites and East Asian young people in these organized sports, blacks still dominate them. Now, some have suggested that black overrepresentation in basketball comes from greater desire on the part of blacks as compared to whites. And certainly there are just as many young whites who desire the multi-million dollar income and popularity of the professional basketball player. But a black person is 29 times, that's an incredible 2,900% more likely to be in the NBA than as a white. It seems logical that the differing performance of whites and blacks has an anatomical and physiological basis. Scientists who have investigated the issue say precisely that. There are indeed numerous physical distinctions between the white and black race. Blacks have a greater proportion of muscle types that favor quick bursts of speed than whites do. They also have less body fat, smaller body cavities, longer arms in relationship to their height, and numerous other differences that contribute to their excelling in sports that favor quick bursts of speed as well as jumping ability. They are favored in sports where those traits are the most important and have a disadvantage where strength and other characteristics are favored. Whites and Asians, for instance, dominate the strength sports of weightlifting and gymnastics, and the higher density in blacks' bones result in less buoyancy and a distinct disadvantage in swimming and other water sports. For a prominent person to discuss these obvious and inherent differences between the races is as taboo as discussing the differences in the brain or the psychological traits that are so critical to the character of a society and civilization. Sports commentators such as Jimmy the Greek and baseball great and Los Angeles Dodger front office employee Al Campanis have been fired or publicly humiliated for saying out loud what most people know by simple observation. Harsh suppression of such obvious truths is a revealing gauge of the intolerance of the egalitarian religion. When I first thought about these things and learned the scientific basis of racial difference, I thought it much like the child's fable, The Emperor's New Clothes. Everyone knew the emperor was wearing only his underwear, but nobody dared to say anything. It simply took the honesty of a little boy to break the bubble of denial. If only it would be that easy, I thought. The racial picture was coming together for me. The races are profoundly different. I saw clearly that the emperor has no clothes. But seeing the emperor of racial equality in a new light was not enough for me. I wanted to know why the emperor came to have no clothes. I wanted to know more about the behavioral differences between the races and how they originated. I already knew enough to know that my inquiry would lead to looking into the process of evolution itself. And the next chapter, ladies and gentlemen, is chapter 9, The Evolution of Race. And in it, I go into the fascinating subject of how the races came to be, how mankind developed, and how very distinct qualities in different races developed. And I also look into questions of so-called egalitarianism or the worth of people, and also the questions of what constitutes superiority or inferiority, and how I believe that using either term, superiority or inferiority, ascribed to a race in general, is really an inaccurate term, because those terms can only apply to certain aspects of character and ability, and that there are different aspects to a human being other than intelligence. So it's a very fascinating chapter, and again, I urge you, if you've not already read My Awakening, the physical book, these are points, questions, studies, ideas that really require not simply listening, but reading and thinking and researching and referral. And anybody who wants to check out my footnotes and documentation is welcome to do so. So on my site, davidduke.com, you can order this book and you can get more data and more information on these subjects. So the next chapter again is chapter 9, The Evolution of Race.